You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including changes in federal funding for homeless programs, the federal government denial of protections for some salmon, and the latest in a dispute over abortion access at a Catholic hospital in Humboldt County. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And Jane, you reported on federal funding changes for homeless services this week. First, can you give us some context for how that all works?
Yeah, so it's a little bit complicated, but basically it all goes through this federal program, which is a housing and urban development program, and it's called the Continuum of Care. And so the goal is to basically help end homelessness. It's a national program, and the government provides funding for states, nonprofits, tribes, local governments, whoever is sort of in charge of that continuum of care to help with that. So the funding is administered regionally, locally, and all kind of trickles down. There are some different sizes of continuums of care, which is kind of interesting. So, for example, Humboldt County is its own continuum of care, but then there's the Northern California continuum of care, which has seven counties. In Oregon, Jackson County has its own continuum of care, but then there's also a 26-county continuum of care, which is most of Oregon. And so the money sort of trickled down through these continuums of care and then ends up going to local service providers. So the continuums of care can apply for grants from HUD, and then the continuum manages that, and then the money trickles down from there so that people can get funding for the projects they're working on.
And what sort of changes did the government make this year?
So in November, HUD announced some major changes to the funding model for their continuum of care program. So they issued a new Notice of Funding Opportunity, or NOFO, which is basically inviting applications for the funding, about $3.9 billion in funding. And there are a lot of changes in that. One of the biggest changes involves sort of what's often called the Housing First model, which is something that HUD had usually supported. And it's basically prioritizing placing people who are homeless in permanent housing. This new NOFO would have decreased the percentage of continuum of care funding that's allocated to permanent housing from about 90% to about 30%. So that's way less money for permanent housing. The press release says that Housing First encourages dependence on government handouts and neglects to address the root cause of homelessness, including illicit drugs and mental illness. So that's from HUD. So instead, they want to focus more on short-term transitional housing and supportive services like substance use treatment. So big change in the priorities for this funding nationally. And so I talked to a bunch of local service providers here who do agree that substance use treatment, transitional housing are really important. They want more funding for those things. But they also wanted more time to prepare if there are going to be these drastic changes. That's a big difference in how this funding has worked in the past. And they also want to really keep their funding for permanent housing because they have people who are sheltered right now. It's keeping people sheltered long term. So if you have someone who's currently housed using permanent housing funds and that money's taken away, are they going to end up back on the street again, which is obviously the opposite of the goal.
Yeah.
And then there are some other big changes, too, in this NOFO. So there's increased competition for these grants nationally. And then the NOFO also says that it's cracking down on DEI, gender ideology extremism, and the misuse and abuse of taxpayer dollars on illegal aliens. So that's from the HUD press release. And so those changes were announced in November, and that led to two lawsuits since then from states and then one from local governments and nonprofits.
Okay, but those changes didn't actually happen. Is that right?
Correct. So just to run through what the changes would have been, the changes were announced in November, and local nonprofits and service providers are all trying to figure out, what does that mean? What are we going to do? Applications due in January. And then on Monday this week, just a few days ago, HUD rescinded the NOFO. So they took it all back, took away the notice of funding opportunity. So the question is, now what? So the announcement says that HUD is going to revise and reissue the NOFO. They didn't announce a timeline for that. And there's some concerns about timing and agencies potentially running out of money because this process takes some time. HUD grants operate on different timelines. So certain ones expire in, you know, the summer versus the fall versus whenever. And so there's a little bit of a holding pattern right now as they try to see what's going to happen next.
And how does this all affect the homeless service providers that you report on just about every week?
Right. Yeah, they're really in a sort of waiting limbo right now. They might need to figure out other ways to get funding for people who are currently housed under permanent housing. Obviously, they don't want them to go back out onto the streets. So do they need to find more funding to keep people housed from somewhere else? There's a lot of sort of uncertainty and confusion and fear. There's a lot going on. They're sort of waiting to see whenever HUD does reissue the NOFO. Again, there's no timeline. It's also heading into the holiday season. What sort of changes might be in the new NOFO? What's the deadline for that? So everyone's sort of waiting and, you know, crossing their fingers to see what the new NOFO might be. And then meanwhile, as we know, homelessness is really generally only continuing to get worse. It's a really big problem. And there's a HUD report that says between 2023 and 2024, homelessness increased nationally by 18%.
Wow.
To the highest number ever recorded. So it's a really big problem, and this funding has really huge impacts on what happens across the country, and then obviously trickles down locally into our community. So we're waiting to see what the administration will decide.
Okay, well, thank you, Jane. Roman, you reported on the federal government denying a petition to protect Chinook salmon. Where are these salmon?
Yeah, so these are Chinook salmon that are along the Oregon coast and then in southern Oregon and northern California along the coast kind of there. There's basically you have to explain how it works. There's these different specific groupings of salmon,
okay.
So different salmon and
steelhead. A Chinook salmon is not a Chinook salmon universally?
They're all Chinook salmon,
okay.
But they're divided into 12 different what are called evolutionary significant units. So these are based on, like, where they spawn.
Got it.
And so, you know, all salmon eventually go to the ocean, but it depends on where they're spawning. So some of these groups, you know, are in places like the Snake River or the Upper Columbia River, or like one of the groups is the Oregon coast. So these two groups are the ones that's the Oregon coast and then the Southern Oregon and Northern California coast groups. So these three environmental groups have petitioned the National Marine Fisheries Service in 2022 to list those two units of Chinook salmon as endangered. And we finally got a decision from the government this week, which was to deny that petition.
And why did the environmental groups want to protect these salmon?
I mean, clearly, because they were worried about them.
Yeah.
You know, they were really kind of concerned about habitat loss. It seems like that was a big point I was seeing a lot in their petition, was the changes to their habitat, things like logging impacting their habitat, dams, impacting stream temperatures, wildfires, all that stuff is just making it harder for these salmon to find places to spawn. They also mentioned a lack of surveying makes it more difficult to monitor these populations. And then they also focused a lot of their petition on the spring run Chinook salmon specifically. They're basically saying that the spring run salmon are doing so bad that all of the salmon should be protected. And then they also said that these fish hatcheries that are run by the government and other groups to, you know, bring in more salmon are promoting the hybridization of the spring and the fall run Chinook, which harms the spring run populations because they're smaller and their genes usually get replaced by the fall run salmon.
Ah.
So they're kind of worried that the spring run salmon are going to get overrun and go extinct.
So these groups that petitioned about the salmon only wanted the spring run salmon to be listed, but they ended up asking for all the salmon to be listed. Why is that?
Yeah. So just for people who don't know, the spring run salmon means salmon that are returning to the river from the ocean in the spring. And then the fall run are obviously returning in the fall. So most Chinook salmon spawn all at the same time in the fall, but the spring run salmon spend, you know, their summers in the river before they continue up.
They take a little
upstream.
Vacation.
Yeah,
first.
Exactly. They literally like hang out in these deep water pools in the rivers, and then they go upstream further to spawn, usually higher than the fall run. So you know, when I talked to the Center for Biological Diversity, they basically said that the main concern is that the habitat loss and the other threats to salmon are more significant for these spring run salmon because they're spending more of their time in the river. They're more susceptible to threats like the higher stream temperatures. And because they spawn higher upstream, they're more susceptible to these habitat loss, like building dams that could block their migration. So they had actually petitioned originally in 2019 for just the spring run salmon to be listed, but the Fisheries Service refused to split them apart. So this petition, they basically said, you know, we want you to protect all the salmon, and that's what we're petitioning for. But they also asked in the petition, like, but if you could split them apart, like, that would
yeah.
be great.
Okay. Well, why did the federal government not agree with the environmental groups?
Yeah, you know, because of the way the groups asked them to protect the spring and the fall run salmon, that is what they looked at. They looked at all of the salmon. They basically said that looking at the species overall, the abundance of the fall run Chinook salmon in this area outweighed the need to protect the spring run salmon. They did kind of note that the spring run salmon, you know, were facing harsher conditions and stuff, but, you know, they basically said that there wasn't enough evidence that the two species were different. They also found that almost all of the spawning habitat was shared between the spring and fall run. Only around 4% of the habitat was just used by the spring run Chinook. So that overlap means that the spring run aren't separated enough, and that is something the environmental groups did disagree with. When I talked to them, they said they have studies that show major genetic differences between the two. One study I looked at found that this premature migration gene developed probably around 10 to 15 million years ago and, you know, was spread across the region. So it's, you know, it's something that was developed independently and
has been going on a long time.
Yeah. So if these spring run salmon were lost, then we wouldn't be able to recover that gene very easily. Interestingly, one thing they noted is that the feds have only listed spring run Chinook salmon independently for inland populations like ones in the Central California Valley or the Snake River, but they haven't done it for any of these coastal populations. So the Center for Biological Diversity said they're going to look at challenging the decision, and then they're also going to look at possibly asking for state level protections from California and Oregon.
Okay, thanks, Roman. I just learned a lot about some fish. Justin, you reported on the latest in a legal battle between the state of California and Providence St. Joseph Hospital in Humboldt County. Remind us, what is this case about?
Yeah, so this case comes down to abortion access. It began last year when the California AG sued the hospital. And that office claimed that St. Joseph broke the law, state law, when it didn't provide an abortion to a woman named Anna Nussloch. And we covered this at the time. So Nussloch was pregnant with twins, but her water broke really early, like 15 weeks into her pregnancy. So she went to St. Joseph, where she said the doctors told her her unborn twins wouldn't survive, unfortunately. She also risked infection and possible death from hemorrhage if she didn't have her pregnancies terminated. But staff didn't perform an abortion because St. Joseph is a Catholic hospital, and they have a policy that unless the woman's life is at risk, they can't terminate a pregnancy. It's against their faith. And then this point, actually, whether Nussloch's life was at risk becomes really important because there's a California law which says hospitals must provide emergency care, even abortions, you know, when someone's life's in danger. Anyways, Nussloch went to a local clinic instead. She had her pregnancies terminated there. And the state, and she claims she started hemorrhaging at that clinic. And overall, it was just a pretty horrible, really risky experience for her.
So California sued the hospital. What happened next?
Well, St. Joseph at first agreed to some stipulations from the state for expanding abortion access. That included providing an abortion if not doing so placed the patient's health in serious jeopardy or would result in serious impairment to the patient's bodily functions or result in serious dysfunction of any bodily organ or part of the patient. So the hospital agreed to that. Then, according to the state, the hospital changed its mind when Bishop Robert Vassa wrote a letter in opposition to that agreement. So Vassa is with the regional diocese. And the bishop laid out the church's opinion on abortion, which is basically unless the woman's life is at risk, unless she's going to die very certainly without the procedure, then it's against their faith. When the hospital left the agreement, the state filed a preliminary injunction against St. Joseph, and now they're seeking a court order for the hospital to expand its emergency abortion care, and a hearing for that injunction was what I listened to this week.
Okay, and what did St. Joseph argue in their defense at this hearing?
So it's very complex. I'm not going to be able to fully summarize everything. You know, this hearing was over 3 hours long. But one big part of St. Joseph's defense was that the women who were denied abortions, and the state actually brought up another case where that person's identity has remained anonymous, these women were not experiencing medical emergencies. And so the hospital did not break California's emergency service law. And the St. Joseph's lawyer cited medical records to that effect. You know, the physicians who saw Nussloc did not write in their notes that she was on the brink of death. The attorney also went as far, this is the attorney for St. Joseph, went as far to say as California's AG has not been honest with the court and kind of stirred up controversy in the community.
And quickly, why is this case important?
It's important because we're in rural Humboldt County, where St. Joseph is actually the only hospital with an OB unit. There's a clinic that recently shut down their birth center, so there's not a lot of options in this area.
Okay, thank you, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.